Chapter 1. The Language of Parables. Part 1. All sacred writings contain an outer and an inner meaning. Behind the literal words lies another range of meaning, another form of knowledge. According to an old age tradition, man once was in touch with this inner knowledge and inner meaning. There are many stories in the Old Testament which convey another knowledge, a meaning quite different from the literal sense of the words. The story of the Ark, the story of Pharaoh's butler and baker, the story of the Tower of Babel, the story of Jacob and Esau and the mess of pottage, and many others contain an inner psychological meaning far removed from their literal level of meaning. And in the Gospels, the parable is used in a similar way. Many parables are used in the Gospels. As they stand, taken in the literal meaning of the words, they refer apparently to vineyards, to households, to stewards, to spendthrift sons, to oil, to water, and to wine, to seeds and sowers and soil, and many other things. This is their literal level of meaning. The language of parables is difficult to understand, just as is, in general, the language of all sacred writings. Taken on the level of literal understanding, both the Old and New Testaments are full not only of contradictions, but of cruel and repulsive meaning. The question arises, why are these so-called sacred writings cast in misleading form? Why is not what is meant explained clearly? If the story of Jacob's supplanting of Esau, or again, of the Tower of Babel, or of the Ark constructed in three stories riding on the flood, is not literally true but has a quite different inner meaning, why is it all not made evident? Why again should parables be used in the Gospels? Why not say directly what is meant? And if a person thinking in this way were to ask why the story of creation in Genesis, which clearly cannot be taken literally, means something else, something quite different from what the literal words mean, he might very well conclude that these so-called sacred writings are nothing but a kind of fraud deliberately perpetrated on mankind. If all these stories, allegories, myths, comparisons, and parables in sacred scripture mean something else, why can it not be stated clearly what they mean from the starting point so that everyone can understand? Why veil everything? Why all this mystery, this obscurity? The idea behind all sacred writings is to convey a higher meaning than the literal words contain, the truth of which must be seen by man internally. This higher, concealed, inner, or esoteric meaning, cast in the words and sense, images of ordinary usage, can only be grasped by the understanding. And it is exactly here that the first difficulty lies in conveying higher meaning to man. A person's literal level of understanding is not necessarily equal to grasping psychological meaning. To understand literally is one thing, to understand psychologically is another. Let us take some examples. The commandment says, "Thou shalt not kill." This is literal, but the psychological meaning is, "Thou shalt not murder in thy heart." The first meaning is literal, the second meaning is psychological, and is actually given in Leviticus. Again, the commandment, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," is literal, but the psychological meaning, which is more than this, refers to mixing different doctrines, different teachings. That is why it is often said that people went whoring after other gods, and so on. Again, the literal meaning of the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," is obvious, but the psychological meaning is far deeper. To steal psychologically means to think that you do everything from yourself, by your own powers, not realizing that you do not know who you are or how you think or feel, or how you even move. It is, as it were, taking everything for granted and ascribing everything to yourself. It refers to an attitude. But if a man were told this directly, he would not understand. So the meaning is veiled because if it were expressed in literal form, no one would believe it, and everyone would think it mere nonsense. The idea would not be understood. And worse still, it would be taken as ridiculous. Higher knowledge, higher meaning, if it falls on the ordinary level of understanding, will either seem nonsense or it will be wrongly understood. It will then become useless and worse. Higher meaning can only be given to those who are close to grasping it rightly. This is one reason why all sacred writings, that is, writings that are designed to convey more than the literal sense of the words, must be concealed, as it were, by an outer wrapping. It is not a question of misleading people, but a question of preventing this higher meaning from falling in the wrong place on lower meaning, and thereby having its finer significance destroyed. People sometimes imagine they can understand anything once they are told it, but this is quite wrong. The development of the understanding, the seeing of differences, is a long process. Everyone knows that little children cannot be taught about life directly because their understanding is small. Again, it is realized that there are subjects in ordinary life that cannot be understood save by long preparation, such as certain branches of the sciences. It is not enough to be merely told what they are about. The object of all sacred writings is to convey higher meaning and higher knowledge in terms of ordinary knowledge as a starting point. The parables have an ordinary meaning. The object of the parables is to give a man a higher meaning in terms of lower meaning in such a way that he can either think for himself or not. The parable is an instrument devised for this purpose. It can fall on a man literally, or it can make him think for himself. It invites him to think for himself. A man first understands on his ordinary matter-of-fact or natural level. To lift the understanding, whatever is taught must first fall on this level to some extent, to form a starting point. A man must get hold of what he is taught to begin with in a natural way, but the parable has meaning beyond its literal or natural sense. It is deliberately designed to fall first on the ordinary level of the mind, yet to work in the mind in the direction of lifting the natural level of comprehension to another level of meaning. From this point of view, a parable is a transforming instrument in regard to meaning. As we shall see later, the parable is also a connecting medium between a lower and a higher level in development of the understanding. Part 2. The Gospels speak mainly of a possible inner evolution called rebirth. This is their central idea. Let us begin by taking inner evolution as meaning a development of the understanding. The Gospels teach that a man living on this earth is capable of undergoing a definite inner evolution if he comes in contact with definite teaching on this subject. For that reason, Christ said,
"I am the way and the truth and the life."
John 14:6. This inner evolution is psychological. To become a more understanding person is a psychological development. It lies in the realm of the thoughts, the feelings, the actions, and in short, the understanding. A man is his understanding. If you wish to see what a man is and not what he is like, look at the level of his understanding. The Gospels speak, then, of a real psychology based on the teaching that man on earth is capable of a definite inner evolution and understanding. The Gospels are, from beginning to end, all about this possible self-evolution. They are psychological documents. They are about the psychology of this possible inner development. That is, about what a man must think, feel, and do in order to reach a new level of understanding. The Gospels are not about the affairs of life, save indirectly, but about this central idea, namely, that man internally is a seed capable of a definite growth. Man is compared with a seed capable of a definite evolution. As he is, man is incomplete, unfinished. A man can bring about his own evolution, his own completion, individually. If he does not wish to do this, he need not. He is then called grass. That is, burnt up as useless. This is the teaching of the Gospels, but this teaching can be given neither directly nor by external compulsion. A man must begin to understand for himself before he can receive it. You cannot make anyone understand by force, by law, but why cannot this teaching be given directly? We come again to the question, why cannot higher meaning be given in plain terms? Why all this obscurity? Why these fairy stories? Why these parables and so on? Everyone has an outer side that has been developed by his contact with life and an inner side which remains vague, uncertain, undeveloped. Teaching about rebirth and inner evolution must not fall only on the outer side of a man, the life-developed side. Some people reach a stage where they realize that life does not satisfy them, where they genuinely begin to look in other directions and seek different aims before they can hear any teaching of an order similar to that of the Gospels. The outer side of a man is organized by life and its demands and is according to his position and capacities. In a sense, it is artificial. It is acquired, but it is only the inner unorganized side of a man which can evolve as does a seed by its own growth from itself. For that reason, the teaching of inner evolution must be so formed that it does not fall solely on the outer side of a man. It must fall there first, but be capable of penetrating more deeply and awakening the man himself, the inner, unorganized man. A man evolves internally through his deeper reflection, not through his outer life, controlled side. He evolves through the spirit of his individual understanding and by inner consent to what he sees as truth. The psychological meaning of the relatively fragmentary teaching recorded in the Gospels refers to this deeper inner side of everyone. Once one can comprehend that a man can evolve only through a growth in his own individual and so inner understanding, one can see that if a true teaching about the meaning of inner evolution falls solely on the outer side of a man, it will be useless or will even appear to him as so much nonsense. It may, in fact, be destroyed by falling on the wrong place in him, on his business side, his worldly side. He will then trample it underfoot. This is the meaning of Christ's remark, "Neither cast your pearls before swine, lest haply they trample them under their feet." Matt 7:6. Under means the outer life side of a man, the lowest side of a man's understanding, the side which only believes in what his senses show him, the side of the mind which touches the earth as do the feet. This side cannot receive the teaching of inner evolution, because it is turned outwards and not inwards. This side therefore cannot understand about rebirth. A man has one birth naturally. All esoteric teaching says that he is capable of a second birth. But this rebirth or second birth belongs to the man in himself, the private, secret man, the internal man, not to the man as he seems to be in life and thinks himself to be, the successful man, the pretended man. All the latter belongs to the outer man, what the man appears to be, not what the man is inwardly. It is the inward man that is the side of rebirth. In the psychological teaching of the Gospels, a man is not taken as what he appears to be, but as what he most deeply is. This is one reason why Christ attacked the Pharisees, for they were appearances. They appeared to be good, just, religious, and so on. In attacking the Pharisees, he was attacking that side of a man that pretends, that keeps up appearances for the sake of outer merit, fear, praise, the man who in himself is perhaps even rotten. The Pharisee, psychologically understood, is the outer side of a man who pretends to be good, virtuous, and so on. It is that side of yourself. This is the Pharisee in every man, and this is the psychological meaning of Pharisee. Everything said in the Gospels, whether represented in the form of parable, miracle, or discourse, has a psychological meaning, apart from the literal sense of the words. Therefore, the psychological meaning of the Pharisee refers not to certain people who lived long ago, but to oneself now, to the Pharisee in oneself, to the insincere person in oneself, who, of course, cannot receive any real and genuine psychological teaching without turning it into an occasion for merit, praise, and award. Later on, we will study the meaning of the Pharisee in oneself more fully. Part 3. Since all sacred writings contain both a literal and a psychological meaning, they can fall in a double way on the mind. If man were capable of no further development, this would have no sense. It is just because he is capable of a further individual evolution that parables exist. The sacred idea of man, that is, the esoteric or inner idea, is that he possesses an unused higher level of understanding, and that his real development consists in reaching this higher possible level. So all sacred writings, as in the form of parables, have a double meaning because they contain a literal meaning designed to fall in the level of man as he is, and at the same time, they can reach up to a higher level, potentially present in him and awaiting him. A parable is cast in the form of an ancient meaning. A parable in the Gospels is cast in the form of an ancient language now forgotten. There was a time when the language of parables could be understood. This language, the language of the parable, allegory, and miracle, is lost to the humanity of today. But sources still remain which enable us to understand something of this ancient meaning. Since the object of the parable is to connect higher and lower meanings, it can be thought of as a bridge between two levels, a liaison between literal and psychological understanding. And as we shall see, a definite language was once well known, in which this double rendering was understood and certain words and terms deliberately used in an understood double sense. Through this ancient language, a connection was made between higher and lower meaning, or, which is the same, the higher and lower sides of man. Our first birth is from the world of cells by evolution into that of man. To be reborn or born again means to evolve up to a higher psychology, a higher possible level of understanding. This is man's supreme aim, according to the teaching of all ancient scriptures, in which man is regarded psychologically as an undeveloped seed. And this is esoteric teaching. This level can only be reached by new knowledge and the feeling and practice of it. And the knowledge that gives a man this possibility is sometimes called in the Gospels truth or sometimes the Word. But it is not ordinary truth or ordinary knowledge. It is knowledge about this further step in development. Let us try to gain some preliminary ideas about this ancient double language of parables. Let us begin by studying how truth is represented. In this ancient language, visible things represent psychological things. Outer life, registered by the senses, is transformed into another level of meaning. Now, truth is not a visible object, but it was represented by means of a visible object in this language. A parable is full of visible imagery of the objects of the senses. But each visual image represents something belonging to a psychological level of meaning, distinct from the image used. In the Gospels, the word water is often used. What does this word mean in the ancient language? In the literal sense of the word, it means the physical substance called water. But psychologically, on a higher level of meaning, it has a different import. Water does not mean simply water. Christ, in speaking of rebirth to Nicodemus, says that a man must be born of water and the Spirit.
Except a man be born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter into the kingdom of God.
John 3:5. What then does water mean? It must have another meaning, a psychological or higher meaning. We might guess, perhaps, that the Spirit means possibly the will or the inmost, most real part of a man. And we might understand that to be born again does not mean literally to enter the womb of the mother again, as Nicodemus thought, who stands for a man capable of only literal understanding. Whatever we may think about the meanings of spirit, we cannot imagine with our ordinary comprehension what water means in this ancient double-sided language, in which things of the senses convey another and special meaning. There is no clue. To say that a man must be born again of physical water is sheer nonsense. What then does water mean psychologically? We can find, by means of other passages in the Bible, what this physical image represents on the psychological level of meaning. 100 examples might be quoted. Let us take one from the Gospels. Christ spoke to the woman of Samaria by the wellside and told her he could give her living water. Christ says to her when she has come to draw water at the well,
"Everyone that drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up into eternal life."
John 4:13-14. It is plain that water is being used in a special sense belonging to this ancient forgotten language. Again, in the Old Testament, in the book of Jeremiah, it is said,
For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water.
Jeremiah 2:13. What then is this water, this living water? In the ancient language, water means truth, but it means a special kind of truth, a special form of knowledge called living truth. It is living truth because it makes a man alive in himself and not dead once the knowledge of it is assented to and applied in practice. In esoteric teaching, that is, teaching about inner evolution, a man is called dead who knows nothing about it. It is knowledge that is true only in reference to the reaching of this higher level of inner evolution awaiting everyone. It is knowledge about this higher level of man and leading to it. It refers to what a man must know, think, feel, understand, and do to reach his next stage of development. It is not outer truth about outer things, outer objects, but inner truth about the man himself and the kind of person he is and how he can change himself. It is therefore esoteric truth, esoteric meaning inner, or truth referring to that inner development and new organization of a man that leads to his next step in real evolution. For no one can change, no one can become different, no one can evolve and reach this higher possible level and so be reborn unless he knows, hears, and follows a teaching about it. If he thinks he knows truth of this order by himself, then he is like those mentioned above who forsake the living waters and hew out for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. The idea is quite plain. A teaching exists and has always existed that can lead to a higher development. This teaching is the real psychological teaching in regard to man and the possible development of the new man in him. Man cannot invent it by himself. He can hew out cisterns for himself, but they hold no water. That is, no truth. When there is no truth of this order, the state of man is sometimes compared with thirst.
The poor and needy seek water, and there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst.
Isaiah 41:17. Or when people follow wrong truth, a comparison is sometimes made with drinking bitter waters, or with undrinkable or polluted water. Let us now apply this idea of water, meaning truth, in this ancient language, to one of the sayings of Christ, and realize what psychological meaning is in contrast to literal meaning. Christ said,
"And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water only, in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward."
Matt 10:42. Here, a literal-minded person will think that all that is necessary is to give a cup of cold water to a child. But if water means truth, then the phrase refers to the handing on of truth, however poorly. And little one here does not mean a child in the Greek, but a person small in understanding. Let us also notice that to receive truth, the mind must be like a cup which receives what is poured into it. That is, a man must be ready and willing to be taught, so that his mind is like a cup to receive water. So the phrase, giving a cup of water, refers both to receiving truth and handing it on to others. All this cannot be logically expressed, but it can be psychologically understood. And this is exactly the intention of the ancient language we have begun to study. Part 4. Other words for truth are used in the esoteric writings of the Old and New Testaments. Water is not the only image used to represent the order of truth that we are studying. In the ancient language, stone and wine are both used as images for this form of truth, but on different scales of meaning. Stone represents the most external and literal form of esoteric truth. It represents esoteric truth in its most inflexible sense. The commandments were written on tables of stone. It must be understood that truth about a higher evolution must rest upon a firm basis for those incapable of seeing any deeper meaning. Let us take briefly the extraordinary story of the Tower of Babel, recorded in Genesis. The ideas centered in this story refer to man trying by his ordinary knowledge to reach a higher level of development. This is the meaning of the tower that was built by man. But from what has been said so far, It can be realized that to reach a higher level for a man personally or for mankind, the teaching of the knowledge necessary for this further step must be known and be followed. Man cannot add to his stature by taking thought. That is, his own ideas, his own thoughts, cannot bring him up to a new level of evolution. He must submit to a teaching. His efforts must be based on this truth that we are studying. And this special knowledge or esoteric truth at its lowest level of comprehending is called stone. We shall see what the Tower of Babel was built of in regard to this necessary knowledge called truth. It was not stone, and it is expressly said that it was not so. That is, it did not come from a higher level of man, from those who have become new men. The story of the Tower of Babel is very strange and has little meaning if we take it literally. It begins by saying that once upon a time after the days of Noah and the Ark, all people had a common language.
And the whole earth was of one language and one speech.
Genesis 11:1. Then it is said that they journeyed from the east, i.e. away from truth, and came to a plain and began to think of building a tower to reach to heaven. Notice how the account continues.
And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, Go to, let us build us a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name.
Notice that they traveled from the east, and they had a brick, a man-made thing, and not stone. The east represents, in the ancient language of parables, the source of esoteric truth. They reached a plain, that is, came down from a higher level, and then began to think that they could of themselves do something, apart from what knowledge of truth they had gained from the east. So they began to build a tower. That is, they thought that they could, out of their own ideas and thoughts, reach to the highest level, here called heaven, and also called similarly in the gospel language. Heaven means a higher level of man, and earth means an ordinary man, the natural man. They began to build for themselves, but notice that it is expressly said that they not only had bricks for stone, but slime for mortar. A higher level cannot be understood by a lower level. A man on a higher level cannot be understood by a man on a lower level. Man as he is cannot reach a higher level unless he comes into possession of the knowledge, called truth, that can lead him to it. So the tower was a failure, and in the strange way in which this ancient language puts things, it looks as if God scattered them out of jealousy. But one must look deeper to understand this language. Man was at fault, not God. Man tried to raise himself by his own knowledge, called here brick and slime, and so was shattered.
And the whole earth was of one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, Go to, let us make brick and burn them throughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. And they said, Go to, let us build a city and a tower, whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth.
Genesis 11:1-9. But it is very difficult to understand the ancient language if we take it literally. We can understand that if an engineer makes some part of an engine that is wrongly measured or of the wrong material, his engine will be no good. He may say, It is God's fault. It is not God punishing. It is a wrong request, and so the response will not be as he hoped. The response will be according to the quality of his request. And this is God, or, if you like, the universe that science studies. A wrong request leads to a wrong response. It is not really a wrong response, but an exactly right response in view of the request. The parable of the Tower of Babel is an illustration of this. Man made a tower out of brick and slime in place of stone and mortar. And God said, that is, response to request, said, this cannot be, in so many words. Now let us look at other examples of stone as a term meaning, in the ancient language, truth, about a higher development. To reach a higher state of himself, a man must request rightly, and for this to come about, a man must know what to ask for. Christ says, ask and ye shall receive. But unless we know something about either the stone or the water of esoteric knowledge, how can we know what to ask for? Christ is not speaking about asking for life, things, but about asking for help in inner evolution and understanding. Certain requests are made in the Lord's Prayer. They are about right asking, but we will study this later. Now let us take the strange incident of Christ renaming Simon. Simon means a hearing, but Christ renamed Simon Peter, which in the Greek is stone. Christ, of course, represents this truth of which we are speaking. He called himself the truth. He spoke of a high level of evolution for each individual man. He taught the means of attaining it. He taught rebirth. Now, in renaming Simon as Peter, he referred to the literal aspect of his teaching. Christ said to Simon,
thou art Peter, and upon this stone I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. I will give unto thee the keys of the kingdom of heaven.
Matt 16:18-19. Simon Peter was given the kings of the kingdom of heaven. Heaven means psychologically this higher level of development intrinsically possible for man. But Christ only gave Peter, as the stone, the keys. The commandments written on stone are keys also, but literally taken they are not enough. They open into psychological meaning. They contain great internal meaning. Esoteric truth in the form of stone is not flexible enough to lead to any real inner development. It must be understood, not merely followed blindly. In Genesis, it is said that Jacob rolled away the stone from the well. The stone in the mouth of the well means in the ancient language that literal truth blocks the psychological understanding of it. The stone was rolled back and the flock watered. For water is the psychological understanding of literal esoteric truth called stone. In this way can the following passage be understood.
Then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the children of the east. And he looked, and behold, a well in the field, and lo, three socks of sheep lying there by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks, and the stone upon the well's mouth was great. And thither were all the flocks gathered, and they rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the sheep.
Genesis 29:1-3. When a stone blocks the well, it means that people have taken esoteric truth literally, in the sense of the words only. They prefer rituals and so on. They literally do not kill but see reason why they should not murder in their hearts. Christ himself, who represents esoteric truth or the way or the word, was called the stone with the builders rejected. The psalmist says,
the stone which the builders rejected has become the head of the corner.
PS 1:18-22. This is a strange phrase. Who are the builders? The builders of what? Of this world? Certainly Christ's teaching came into a world built of violence, a world in which everyone believed that violence leads to something better. But when Christ is called the stone, it means that fundamentally he was so. His whole teaching, however, was to transform stone into water and finally water into wine. The Jews understood everything literally as stone. Christ transformed literal into psychological meaning. This is shown in one of the miracles, which are really psychological miracles. That is, the transformation of literal meaning into psychological understanding. A man who is bound down to the literal meaning of higher truth can destroy himself. This explains, perhaps, why some religious people seem to be destroyed by their contact with religion and made worse than life would make them. This is possibly shown in the account in the 5th chapter of Mark of the man with an unclean spirit, who came out of the tombs, of whom it is said he was always cutting himself with stones, Stones, that is, taking higher truth at a literal level, cut him, made him unclean. And since Jesus represented, let us say at present, a higher understanding of literal truth, the man cried out to him,
"What have I to do with thee, Jesus?"
And Jesus said,
"Come forth, thou unclean spirit, out of the man."
The man means the man's understanding, which is the real man. But this is only a slight glimpse of the meaning of this miracle, parable. It refers to a certain state of a man in regard to higher teaching. The point here is that the man cut himself with stones. That is, took higher truth literally and was therefore unclean. And his uncleanness had to pass into the swine. But perhaps we shall be able to understand something more of what this means later on. Jesus always represents the non-literal or non-ritualistic understanding of higher truth. The Jews in the Gospels represent not actual, literal people, but a certain literal level of taking everything belonging to higher truth. Everyone is a Jew who cannot get from the sense of the letter to the psychological meaning. So the Jews are said to stone Christ when Christ said,
"I and the Father are one."
It is said that
the Jews took up stones again to stone him,
because their literal minds thought his words were blasphemy. The inner meaning is that people on the level of literal and so ritualistic, external understanding throw this meaning at people who stand above its level. One can even be stoned by what one once understood in a literal way and now understands quite differently. And one can always stone a man through his actual literal words without allowing any existence to what he really meant. And literal law of the legal courts is and must be based on stone, that is, on what you actually said in words and not on what you meant. Part 5. Let us speak for a moment about wine used as an image for truth. We shall study the meaning of esoteric truth when it has reached the stage of wine in a man's understanding later. But at present we must understand that stone is the literal form of esoteric truth, and water refers to another way of understanding the same truth, and wine to the highest form of understanding it. In the miracle recorded in the second chapter of St. John's Gospel, Christ turned water into wine. In this account, it is said that he asked the servants to fill the stone jars with water, and then he transformed the water into wine. That is, three stages of a man's relation to truth are shown. And this means, of course, three stages in the understanding of esoteric truth. Part 6. The idea of wine leads naturally to the idea of vineyards, which produce wine. Before we can continue more fully the study of the ancient language of parables, we must look at the meaning of vineyards and try to get some idea of their significance. It will be necessary to speak further of this truth that refers to a man's inner development and growth of understanding. This truth is not ordinary truth. It is sown on the earth. For example, Christ taught this particular kind of truth. In the Sermon on the Mount, he spoke quite openly about certain aspects of it, but the deeper aspects of it he concealed under the guise of parables. Man cannot invent this truth for himself. We have seen that this is indicated in the story of the Tower of Babel, where men thought they could reach heaven by means of brick and slime instead of stone and mortar. Higher truth, which simply means truth that leads to a higher level of self-evolution, does not arise in life but comes from those who have already reached this higher level. Many have reached it. Some few of them are recorded in ordinary history. Let us confine ourselves to Christ. He taught this higher truth, but he spoke many things about the establishment of this special order of truth on earth and used the image of a vineyard. A school of teaching based on truth of this order was called by him a vineyard, and its object was to produce fruit. If it did not, it was cut down. Christ also speaks of himself as a vine, and he says to his disciples,
"I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same beareth much fruit, for apart from me ye can do nothing."
John 15:5. Christ relates the following parable about a vineyard.
"A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit thereon, and found none. And he said unto the vine dresser, Behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and find none. Cut it down. Why doth it always cumber the ground? And he answering saith unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it, and if it bear fruit thenceforth, well, but if not, thou shalt cut it down.
Luke 13:6-9. From this point of view, man was regarded as capable of a special growth, a special inner development, and vineyards were established to make this development possible. Of course, they were not actual vineyards, they were schools of teaching. What did they teach? They taught, first of all, the knowledge that could lead, if practiced, to the higher level of development inherent in man. What they taught a man was that he was an individual, that is, unique, who could reach this higher state of himself, and that this was his real meaning, and that this only could satisfy him most deeply. They began with teaching this truth, or knowledge of this special truth, but they led to something else. They led from truth to a definite state of a man where he acted no longer from the truth that brought him up to this level, but from the level itself. This was sometimes called good. All truth must lead to some good state as its goal. This was the idea belonging to the term vineyard. Wine was produced. A man began to act from good, not truth, thus becoming a new man. The idea of temptation in the Gospels. Part 1. As we shall study in the next chapter, the miracle of the transformation of water into wine, which in its internal or psychological meaning is about a certain definite stage reached by Jesus in his individual evolution, approximately just before he began to teach, it may be as well to consider the temptations of Jesus and the idea of temptation and its general significance in the Gospels in this connection. Now here it is necessary to grasp clearly something that is not usually understood. What has to be grasped is that Jesus had to undergo inner growth and evolution. He was not born perfect. Had this been the case, he would not have suffered temptation or experienced such despair. Some religious people make a mistake in thinking that Christ had from the start such exceptional powers that anything was possible to him. But as one instance, Jesus mentions the difficulty of healing a certain form of illness and says that much prayer and fasting is necessary before it can be undertaken. Later on, we shall study some of these examples, but it can be said that the most extraordinary views exist about the unlimited powers that Jesus had on earth. So much so that people even argue that if he were the Son of God, why did he not heal all sickness and convert the whole world? This is the same kind of argument used by people who say that if there is a God, why are pain, illness, suffering, war, and so on allowed on earth? The whole standpoint of both arguments is wrong. The idea of the meaning of life on earth is not grasped. In fact, the central idea of the Gospels is not grasped. Namely, the idea of individual evolution and rebirth. Let us repeat the words used above to make the issue of this chapter as clear as possible. Jesus had to undergo inner growth and evolution. Let us start from this point. Jesus was not born perfect, as a fully developed, a fully evolved man. On the contrary, he was born imperfect in order to carry out a certain long prophesied task. He had to re-establish, at a critical period in human history, a connection between the two levels called, in the Gospels, earth and heaven. And this had to be done in himself practically, so as to reopen a way for influences from a higher level of the universe of total being, which extends up through different degrees of the divine being to absolute being. To reach mankind on earth and so make it possible for man to have a possibility of inner development, and also for some kind of intelligent culture to exist for a definite period or cycle of history. Of this period, Jesus asks himself whether
faith will be found on earth.
At its culmination,
howbeit when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on earth?
Such are the words of Christ, and these words suggest that he doubted whether faith would be found on earth at the end of this cycle. Jesus then had to bridge the human and the divine in himself, and this way re-establish a connection between heaven and earth. He had to undergo all the difficulties of an inner evolution of the human in him so that it became subject to the higher or divine level. He had to pass through all the stages of this evolution in himself by trial and error until it was perfected, through endless inner temptations of which we are only given a few glimpses. And all this took place over a long period about which we only know something of the teaching he gave during the latter part of it, which terminated in the final humiliation and so-called catastrophe of the crucifixion, and a few details of the earliest part, but nothing of the comparatively long intervening part. Here is silence. We do not know where Jesus was taught during this period, or by whom he was given directions for the final drama he had to enact, the heralding of which was given to John the Baptist, who did not know him by sight, and the ordained culmination of which is referred to by Jesus in many places, and in the miracle of the transformation of water into wine, in the words he is made to say to his mother,
"Mine hour is not yet come."
He does not say mother, but woman. Yet some religious people imagine that Jesus was crucified because of Pilate, as it were by chance. This view is absurd. He had to play the part allotted to him. It was pre-arranged. Now, in the earliest references to the development of Jesus, it is said that he advanced in wisdom and stature. Jesus advanced by stages. In Luke, it is said,
"The child grew and waxed strong in spirit and was filled with wisdom, and grace was upon him."
Luke 2:52. Luke, who never saw Jesus, also records his first words when he was found in the temple at the age of 12 by his father and mother after a search of 3 days. His mother is made to say,
"Son, why have you treated us like this? Do you know your father and I have sought you sorrowing?"
To which Jesus is made to answer,
"How is it that ye sought me? Do you not know that I must be in all that belongs to my Father?"
Notice the distinction between Father on earth and Father in heaven is made. That is, between the idea of the first earthly birth and the second higher birth, which was the subject of Christ's teaching. Even at the age of 12, those who listened to him in the temple were amazed at his understanding and his answers. The idea, then, of Jesus advancing in understanding is quite distinct. It is clear that a long period elapsed before he had advanced to his full inner stature and attained his supreme development, called in the Gospels the moment of his glorification. This final fulfillment of his evolution began when Judas went out into the night to betray him, as it is called, and when Jesus said to his remaining disciples,
"Now is the Son of Man glorified."
But even then, it was not yet attained, for he obviously had to undergo two further and very severe temptations. The temptation in Gethsemane, where he prayed,
"O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass away from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt."
And the temptation on the cross, where he cried out,
"My God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
Here must also be remarked that Christ began to teach some 3 years before he attained glorification, that is, before his full development. Let us ask ourselves, how is inner evolution reached? All inner development is possible only through inner temptation. 3 temptations of Christ by the devil are mentioned in detail in the early parts of the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, and referred to very briefly in Mark, in terms of wild beasts. Nothing is said of this in John, but the miracle of water into wine is made as the starting point of the teaching and miracles of Jesus. Let us study for the present the version of the 3 early temptations as given in Luke, in order to realize that Jesus had to advance by undergoing development by the method of temptation, and so pass through stages of inner growth by means of inner self-conquest. But let us first remember that the conception of mankind in its unawakened state, as given in the Gospels, is that it is the power of evil and This is represented by the idea that man is infested by evil spirits. That is, man is under the power of evil moods and impulses and thoughts, which are personified as evil spirits, whose object is the destruction of a man and of the human race. The conception of the Gospels is that man is continually being dragged down by evil forces, which are in him, not outside him, and to which he consents. By man's consent to these forces in himself, progress in human life is prevented. The evil powers are in man, in his own nature, in the very nature of his self-love, his egotism, his ignorance, his stupidity, his malice, his vanity, and also his thinking only from the senses and taking the seen world, the outer appearances of life, as the only reality. These defects are collectively called the devil, which is the name for the terrible power of misunderstanding everything that undeveloped man possesses, the power of wrongly connecting everything. The devil is the aggregate of all these deficiencies, all these powers of misunderstanding in man, and all their transmitted results. So the devil is called the slanderer or scandal maker from one point of view, and the accuser from another point of view. But we shall see a little more clearly what is meant by the devil when we begin to understand what temptation really means. In the account of the tempting of Christ by the devil given in Luke, it is said that Jesus was in the wilderness for 40 days, being tempted of the devil. This number 40 appears in the account of the flood, where the rain lasted for 40 days and nights, in the allegorical account of the children of Israel wandering 40 years in the wilderness. And it is said also of Moses that he fasted 40 days and nights before he received the commandments, written on tablets of stone. Here in Luke, the 40 days in the wilderness are directly connected with the idea of temptation.
Jesus was led by the Spirit in the wilderness during 40 days, being tempted by the devil. And he did eat nothing in those days, and when they were completed, he hungered.
Luke 4:1-2. Then comes a description of the first resulting temptation of this period of temptation, which is represented in the following way.
And the devil said unto him, If thou art the Son of God, command this stone, that it becomes a loaf of bread.
Luke 4:3. Let us take the superficial literal or first level of meaning. Christ hungered, and the devil suggests that he should transform a stone into bread.
And Jesus answered and said unto him, It is written, Man shall not live by bread alone.
Luke 4:4. On the literal level, this is just as it appears, a physical temptation. Notice, however, that it is said above that Jesus was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted of the devil. If we suppose the wilderness to be a literal physical wilderness, how is it that nothing is said about how he was being tempted all this time? One might merely say that he was starving. But in connection with inner development, we must understand by the term wilderness a state of mind, a general inner state comparable with a literal wilderness. That is, a state where there is nothing to guide a man, where he is no longer among familiar things, and so is in a wilderness, a state of distress and bewilderment and perplexity, where he is left entirely to himself, as a test, and does not know in which direction to go and must not go in his own direction. This itself is temptation, for all the time he is being starved of meaning. Why should a man leave the familiar and go into a wilderness? He hungers for bread, not literal bread, but that bread that we ask for in the Lord's Prayer, so wrongly translated as daily bread, namely guidance, transubstantial bread. And literally, bread for the tomorrow. In fact, meaning for the development of our lives, not for our lives as they are today, now, but as they can become, the bread necessary for our support in growing, the bread for successive and necessary stages of understanding. For the Lord's Prayer is a prayer about inner evolution, and the bread asked for is the bread of understanding necessary for it. In such a state, the temptation is to make bread for oneself, that is, to follow one's own ideas, one's own will. Exactly as the builders of the Tower of Babel used bricks and slime of their own making in place of stone and mortar, They thought they could make a new world from their own ideas. Why should one not fall back on oneself and so on life once more, instead of waiting for something that seems doubtful? In Matthew, the answer of Christ to this temptation is,
"Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God."
Matthew 4:4. See clearly that the devil had asked Christ to make bread by himself to ease his state. That is, not to await the word of God. The devil says,
"If thou art the Son of God, command that these stones become bread."
That is, nourish yourself by your own powers and ideas. But the mission of Christ, which began immediately after the temptations in the wilderness, was not to manufacture truth and meaning by himself, but to understand and teach the truth and meaning of the Word of God, that is, of a higher level of influences. The test was as to his own self-will and the will of a higher level. He had to do the will of God, not his own will. He had to bring the lower human level in himself under subjection to the will of the higher or divine level. It is the human level here that is under temptation, for Jesus was born of a human mother. To mistake the lower for the higher is the annihilation of a man, for then he will ascribe to himself what does not belong to him. A man will then be tempted to say, "I am God," and not, "God is I." If he says, "I am God," he identifies himself with God from a lower level. This annihilates him. If he says, "God is I," he surrenders his self-will and makes the will of God, I, in him, and so is under and must obey God. That is, a higher level. Notice that the devil is made to address Jesus in the words, "If thou art the Son of God," and so suggests that Jesus can do as he likes, as if he were at the level of God. All this was in Jesus. It took place in him. And although this temptation can be taken quite simply as one relative to overcoming the appetites, in this case, hunger, it is clear that other and far deeper meanings lie behind the literal meaning, and that they are concerned with those problems of self-love and power and violence in which human nature is rooted. Jesus had human nature in him from the woman, his mother. The task was to transform it. This is quite obvious in the second temptation, where Christ is offered all power over the visible world. The devil is represented as leading Christ to a high place and showing him all the kingdoms of the world in a point of time.
"He led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said unto him, To thee will I give all this authority and the glory of them, for it hath been delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will give it. If thou therefore wilt worship before me, it shall be thine."
Luke 4:5-7. This is temptation as to earthly power and the deep vanity that lies in everyone. It is again directed to the self-love. It includes love of the world and its possessions. The devil will give Christ the world. Love of power, authority, and love of possessions represents two sides of self-love. Here the human level in Christ is represented as being subject to the most tremendous temptation conceivable in regard to worldly gain and possessive power. The temptation is described in such a way as to bring this out clearly. The whole world is presented to Jesus in a point of time, that is, simultaneously. Jesus is made to answer,
"It is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve."
That is, not the world and its possessions. The answer is from the same ground of understanding as that given in the first temptation. There is something apart from the world and the love of possessing it. There is something else that man must possess. This higher level, both possible to man and already in a man, is the direction in which his desire for power and glory must turn. But even although a man knows and is quite certain about this direction, he can still be tempted, and even more so. Otherwise, Christ would not have been tempted in this way. His human side was still open to this temptation. It is not only the overwhelming effect of the senses and any immediate appeal to self-interest and vanity that has to be thought of here, but perhaps the far subtler ideas of being able, by worldly means and outer power and authority, to help mankind by becoming a king on earth. We know that the disciples thought Jesus was going to be an earthly king, possessing the whole world and give them earthly rewards. They thought from the lower level about higher things. They could not at first see what Jesus was talking about, namely the reaching of a higher or inner level, which has nothing to do with the lower or outer level of life. We must remember here that the path that Christ had to follow led to apparent failure in outer life and outer powerlessness, and to a death reserved only for the worst criminals. He had only a few ultimate followers. It looked as if everything had been useless. Certainly, we cannot expect to understand this unless we grasp the whole idea of two levels. But we shall speak more of this later on, and only say here that temptation in the real sense is about these two levels and relates to the passage from one to the other. If Jesus had been born perfect, he would have been beyond all temptation. He would not have represented the new man or the way to it. He called himself the way. I am the way for this reason. Part 2. There are different ways in which we can be tempted and different ways in which we can yield to temptation. Let us speak of temptation in general. All temptation, if it is real, implies a struggle between two things in a man, each of which aims at getting control. This struggle has two forms. It is always either between what is true and what is false, or between what is good and what is bad. The whole inner drama of man's life and the result of it all, in terms of his inner development, lie in this struggle about what is the truth and what is a lie, and what is good and what is bad. And actually, it is these things that everyone is always thinking and wondering in the privacy of his mind and heart. The mind is for thinking what is true and the heart for perceiving what is good. Let us take the first temptation in regard to truth. This takes place in the intellectual life of a person. Everyone holds to certain things he regards as true. Knowledge itself is not truth, for we know many things but do not regard all of them as necessarily true, or we are indifferent to them. But out of all the things we know, some we hold to be true. This is our personal truth, and it belongs to our personal intellectual life, for knowledge and truth are of the mind. Now, the intellectual life of a man is nothing but what he believes to be true, and when this is assailed in any way, he feels anxiety. The more he values what he believes to be true, the more anxiety will he feel when doubt enters his mind. This is a mild state of temptation in which a man must think about what he believes and values as truth and from it fight with his doubts. You must understand that no one can be tempted about what he does not value. It is only in connection with what he values that he can be tempted. The meaning of temptation is to strengthen all that a man values as truth. Throughout the Gospels, the idea that man must struggle and fight in himself is apparent. The Gospels are about the inner development and evolution of a man. This demands inner struggle. That is, temptation is necessary. But people are sometimes offended at the idea that they must fight for truth and must go through temptations in regard to it. But it is necessary to fight for knowledge as much as to fight with oneself. Now let us take temptation in regard to good. This is not intellectual, but emotional. It belongs to the side that a man wills, not what he thinks. The basis of what a man wills is what he feels is good. Everyone wills and acts from what he feels is good, and all that a man wills belongs to his voluntary life. Nothing else makes the voluntary life of a man but that which he has impressed upon himself as being good. If all that a man holds as good were taken away from him, his voluntary life would cease. Just as if all that a man believes to be truth were taken away from him, his intellectual life would cease. Now in the Gospels, all truth has to do with knowledge of the teaching given by Christ, and all good has to do with the love of God and the love of one's neighbor. Now, whatever a man loves, he regards as good, and whatever he regards as good, he wills and acts from. If he only loves himself, then he is a man to whom good means only his own good, and anything that does not apply to his own good, he will regard as bad. The development of the will is through the development of the love, and the development of the love is at the expense of the self-love. Now, since a man can only be tempted intellectually through what he values as truth, he can only be tempted in regard to his will and deeds through what he loves. And since all temptation in a real sense is about the truth of the word, that is, the teaching of the Gospels, and the good of the word, temptation as to good, as distinct from truth, only begins when a man begins to pass beyond the level of self-love into what is called charity or love of neighbor through a sense of the existence of God as the source of love. Temptations as to truth necessarily begin long before temptations as to good. But if there is no sort of natural charity in a man, his temptations as to truth will be less easy to pass through. Truth must enter and grow in a man first before he can change the direction of his will. That is, before his feeling of what is good can change. When he begins to feel the feeling of new good entering him, the two feelings will alternate. Later, he will feel a struggle between the new good and what he formerly felt as good. But by this time, he should be able to hold on to truth, however he fails in regard to good. The man is really between two levels, lower and upper, and all real temptation only begins when this is the case, for the lower level attracts him and he has to find a path between them. Actually, he lifts himself up a little and falls back like a drunken man trying to get off the floor. But if temptation as to good really begins, whatever it results in at any time, he must never let failure or apparent failure war against the truth on to which he is holding. If he does, he will lose some sense of truth with each failure. Whatever he is or does, he must hold to the truth he has received and keep it alive in him. Part 3. In the third temptation of Christ, the devil once more begins by saying, "If thou art the Son of God." We must understand that Christ had to fight against self-love in all its forms and all kinds of earthly loves and everything derived from them. He had to overcome every feeling of self-power arising from the human level in him so as to make it subject to the higher level. Now, temptation in a real sense has to do with the relation of the lower level in a man to any higher possible level. Bear in mind that the central idea in the Gospels is that a man should pass from a lower to a higher state, and that this is inner evolution or rebirth. Since the Word of God is teaching about the means necessary for this inner evolution, all intellectual temptation in the Gospels refers to a man's private thoughts about the truth of the Word and the truth of the senses, and all emotional temptation is about self-love and the love of God. There is, naturally, disagreement between the lower and the higher level, just as we might say there is a disagreement between a seed and a plant. We might say that a seed can live for itself and be full of its self-love, or it can surrender itself and its self-will to the higher influences that seek to operate on it, so that it becomes, by transformation, a plant. The third temptation is given in these words in Luke.
And he led him to Jerusalem, and set him on the pinnacle of the temple, and said unto him, If thou art the Son of God, cast thyself down from hence, for it is written, He shall give his angels charge concerning thee, to guard thee, and on their hands they shall bear thee up, lest haply thou dash thy foot against a stone. And Jesus answering said unto him, It is said, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God.
Luke 4:9-12. It can be understood that the self-love necessarily only worships itself. So it can and actually does ascribe divineness to itself. That is, the lower imagines it is the higher and so tempts God. It cannot feel its own nothingness and so swells itself up to heaven. And then in the intoxication of its own divinity, in the madness of self-illusion, it may attempt the impossible and destroy itself. In the accounts of the temptation by the devil, it is said that Christ was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. In Luke, he was
led by the Spirit in the wilderness during 40 days being tempted of the devil.
In Mark, the expression is stronger.
And straightway the Spirit driveth him forth into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days tempted of Satan, and he was with the wild beasts.
Mark 1, 12-13. In Matthew,
then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil.
Matthew 4:1. The temptations in the wilderness in each gospel where they are described are made to follow on the baptism of Jesus by John. It seems strange that Christ should be led into temptation by the very Spirit of inner illumination with which he was filled. But Christ taught that a man must be born again of the Spirit, and without temptation, there is no transformation. The Spirit is the connecting medium between higher and lower. The human in Christ had to be transformed and lifted up to the divine level. And since the Spirit is the intermediary, drawing the lower by a series of transformations to the higher, the work of the Spirit is to lead a man into the wilderness, nay, rather into utter bewilderment, and subject him to being tempted by every element in himself, so that all that is useless for his self-evolution is put behind him, and all that can grow and understand is put in front. The devil represents all in a man that cannot evolve, and all that does not wish to and hates every idea of inner evolution, all that wishes only to slander and misunderstand and have its own way. All this must gradually be put behind a man who seeks real inner development and not allowed to take the first place and control him. That is, the order of things in a man must change and what is first becomes last. So in one of the accounts of Christ is made to say to the devil, "Get thee behind me, Satan," that this new inner order in a man which is brought about by temptation cannot take place at once is clear from Luke's words, where it is said that the temptations of Christ were not ended. The devil, it is said, departed from him for a season. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.